Welcome to the Secured Podcast. This is Mike Matranga, your host, and co-host Mike Montsev with ASAP Security Services. Today, we're going to talk about a few things that may be somewhat controversial, but if you know us, you know us well. We're not going to shy away from the topics that everybody else is scared to talk about. With that said, I want to start out, just kind of start us off with right to it. Last month, March, there was a report, NBC News report, of a student in Oklahoma that was attacked by a group of other students due to a bullying incident. That bullying incident then led to that student being hospitalized for a short period of time and then later taking their life due to an overdose of a mixture of over-the-counter medication and prescription drugs. So
here's a question. Why did it make the news?
Why did it make the news?
Because this happens all the time. Why did this case make the news?
Because this kid is transgender. That's why. And we're going to talk about that, right?
Sure.
So I'll start out with the NBC News report. It's titled Death of Transgender Student Nex Benedict Ruled Suicide by Medical Examiner. Just going to give you a little bit of a quick background as much as I can before we get into some conversation. So the article is written on March 13th, 2024. It says the death of Oklahoma student Nex Benedict has been ruled a suicide according to a medical examiner's report released Wednesday. The 16-year-old who was transgender and used he and they pronouns, let's talk about that, according to friends and family, died February 8th, a day after a fight at Eswasso High School. His name has become a rallying cry among LGBTQ activists who argue that an onslaught of legislation targeting the community has made schools less safe for queer and transgender students like Nex. Nex had reportedly told his mother that he faced bullying at school over his gender identity and body camera footage released last month by police from the hours after the school fight shows Nex lying in a hospital bed. In the video, he tells a police officer how three students jumped him after he threw water on them because they were bullying him and his friend for the way they dressed. The Oswasso Police Department released preliminary information from an autopsy report on February 21st. They said shows Nex's death was not the result of trauma. Days later, a spokesperson for the department clarified that the fight had not been ruled out as having contributed to or caused the death. The medical examiner's report listed a probable cause of death as combined toxicity from two drugs, one of which is available over the counter and the other by prescription. So with that said, based upon early reports, what I'm gathering is that Nex Benedict, transgender student with he and they pronouns, had been bullied. And I guess the bullying had gotten to a point where he couldn't handle it anymore. He threw water on the students. They then assaulted him. And I do recall watching the video of him being in a hospital, appeared to be very coherent, speaking and laughing and joking with the police officer. But then just a few short days later, Nex is now deceased and kills himself due to overdose of medications.
Well, I think a couple things. The only reason why we're hearing about it is because it involves the transgender headline.
Right.
Unfortunately, suicide in especially in high school is a problem.
Right.
Sure. And it's not unique to just K-12 schools. This is the leading reason or cause for death. And I think, 18 to 24 year olds, something like that.
Yeah.
So much so that we're seeing, a lot of the collegiate university level building buildings, rolling out programs, telehealth programs available for free to all students. And the ones that are really proactive are doing that. Because they see that being as the number one cause of death, the suicide, they need to do something about it. So the universities that are really in tune with their students are really stepping up in a big mm-hmm. way. They obviously have different pockets than the K-12 side does. It's unfortunate that this happened, right? It's unfortunate that bullying leads to suicide. I think it's more unfortunate that these incidents happen every day in the United States.
And we don't hear about it.
And we don't hear about it.
Right.
And it takes somebody in the media having to label it transgender for it to actually carry any weight. What about all of those other deaths that were caused by suicide from bullying that didn't have transgender tied to it?
Which
that
we far outnumbers.
Yeah, we never got to see it. So while transgender is definitely a topic here, I think there's also, you know, just the fact that this happens every day in bullying, and we don't hear about it at all.
And I think that that's kind of the rub that I have is, you know, that is as unfortunate and as tragic as this event is, that this child lost their life, you know, felt like they had no other out but to take their own life due to, you know, the onslaught of bullying, that
social pressures.
Yeah, social pressures, you name it. I mean, you know, being in that LGBTQ community, there's a lot of social pressures and stress that comes with that, right?
Well, I mean, let's talk about it in general. I mean, middle school and high school is rough.
Anyway,
right?
Even if you're heterosexual,
it doesn't matter where you are. If you're, you know, a sports athlete, if you're an academic athlete, if you're just going to school, I mean, there's entire movies around it. Mean Girls. I mean, this is true, right? Like, I mean, it is a time of that point in the adolescent life where they kind of have to figure out who they are and what kind of person they're going to ultimately grow up to be, right?
Yeah. Mean Girls was a little bit after my vintage and your vintage of being in high school. It came out afterwards. My kids watched it. They, you know, and my wife, you know, watched it, whatnot. But the first one I remember of really, you know, first movie I can remember that kind of focused on the social pressures of high school was, it was Karate Kid was one. Daniel LaRusso moves in to, you know, Redondo. I don't know.
Somewhere
in California, he's trying to fit in, you know, social pressures, whatnot. But then the other one that really sticks out to me was Can't Buy Me Love.
Well, I thought you were going to go with Dazed and Confused.
Well, no, not Dazed and Confused, but Can't Buy Me Love, right?
Right.
Where kid's kind of a nerd, he's social pressures, whatnot. He's, you know, trying to win the girl over, whatnot. Ends up working out for him, but we all know that those are fairy tale endings in movies. It doesn't always end up that way, right?
Not at all.
And so, you know, what I think is one of the biggest crises in America is the mental health component or mental health crisis that we're seeing at all levels, and not just amongst our kids, but amongst our adult population.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, you touched on one thing that I wanted to talk about, and I don't even know if our viewers know about this, but, you know, you went to a conference here last month about the same time that this happened in Oklahoma to Texas A&M.
Yep.
And they have really focused on this. Can you tell us about their program?
Yeah, I was blown away, to be honest with you. It, you know, I feel like sometimes the stuff that we talk about, some people say maybe edgy or controversial. But I think that, you know, time and time again, we've proven that we're talking about things that the rest of the world just hasn't caught up to. I mean, if you go back to when you first stepped into K-12, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you were in the New York Times over things that schools are doing every day today.
Now. That back
right?
then, back they were then, like, this guy's four, crazy.
Right? And so I feel like we're just doing us, and we're just kind of out in front, right? And so when we talk about mental health and we talk about the needs and the resources and how broken the process is today, mm-hmm. and how, you know, some of the stuff that is the process of just going through, identifying how to go through the process for help, it's archaic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Way, right? I mean, this stuff hasn't evolved, you know, well at all. And I mean, I think it's one of the things that we, you know, we have our own passion project and we're dedicating our own resources to because we see this as such a need. So when I go somewhere and somebody has taken drastic steps, huge step, really stepped out there, I was in awe, right? I mean, I was truly shocked, did not expect it. But so Texas A&M University has rolled out telehealth to every single solitary student within the system, free of charge.
154,000.
You know, Corpus Christi A&M, Prairie View, you name it, every single solitary thing in the Texas A&M system, those students 24 hours a day have access to mental health help live.
For free,
right?
Yeah.
Touch of a button, right? And you can't possibly think of a better way to spend money than potentially preventing one of these suicides. I mean, if they save one life, 10 lives, I mean, the money is well spent, right? And that's what it's about. It's about preparing our young people to go out in the world to be productive members of society. So they've done that. They also are in the process of finishing up a huge, massive building that is going to be staffed on main campus, and this is in College Station, that's going to be staffed with mental health professionals that they can just walk in and be seen.
All free.
Yeah. As part of their tuition in there. And it's not like they raised the tuition. They realized that this was a need, and they're taking the steps. They are really putting their money where their
mouth is. So what do you think is preventing the K-12 space from doing the same thing?
Well, I'm going to tell you,
unregulated market.
One thing that we're seeing like right now today, is the K-12 market got used to COVID money.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And so these past several years, they've gotten accustomed to that money, and it's the faucet's turned off, right? And so the buzz right now that we're consistently seeing across K-12 is we have a $1.8 million
deficit
next year.
Yeah.
We have a $10.12 million shortfall next year. And I'm watching all of these districts trying to figure out, how do I provide the services I need? How do I staff appropriately? And at the same time, I am losing all this funding.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you right now, this summer, there's going to be a lot of work being done behind the scenes, trying to figure out how to hire staff when they're paying more for staff than they've ever paid before, right? It's highly competitive because they're short on staff. You have other teachers who are tired of dealing with things, and administrators who are exiting. So now you have less of a pool to pull from, and then you turn around and they're short $1 million, $2 million,
right.
$10 million. How do they come up with that? I don't know how they're going to navigate it.
Well,
I don't.
And I think that's at some point what we're going to have to understand is that, or what our politicians at both the state or local, state and federal level are going to have to understand is that if we want to create a safe climate in our K-12 campuses, our first priority should not be police response. It should be mental health resources.
Well, and it's that same thing that we talk about all the time about preventative, right? Versus being proactive versus reactive.
Right.
And historically, everything in security, specifically in K-12, has been reactive based.
Well, and we're going to come back to that, but let's go back to this next Benedict thing,
sure.
Right? So, you know, let's talk about this evolution that we're seeing in American society of normalizing, you know, the transgender movement, right? You're 100% right. The reason why this caught national news attention compared to the probably hundreds within that same time period of kids who've killed themselves throughout the United States is because Next was transgender.
Right.
He, you know, had he, they pronouns.
It'd be really interesting to have one of the statisticians that we know
pull that data.
That.
Yeah. I'd like to talk to David Reedman,
See
if that's something that he can work on. Because, you know, what about the other kids? What about the other hundreds of kids that killed themselves this year already due to bullying or, you know, whatever it was, right? You know, we have to understand as a society that though our media is extremely important for us to relay information to us accurately, we also need to understand that there's a certain piece of manipulation that's involved with that. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but you know, this is not drawing attention to really suicide in general. This is drawing attention to transgender issues, which is a hot button topic at the national level. And that's unfair to all the families who've lost a child or a loved one due to suicide for whatever reason that's not transgender.
Right.
You know, for us to prioritize this because it's, you know, a transgender child is just not fair. I don't think that's right.
Yeah,
you know, and shame on the media for doing that.
It furthers the divide, Right. I mean, that's ultimately what this is, right? The more that you put this out there, the more that you push this, these stories, right? It just continues to do that. So, I mean, this was in Oklahoma, right?
Right.
It carried nationally, mm-hmm. right? It wasn't like it was just picked up.
No, it was national.
It was national. AP yeah. ran with it, and they ran across the board with it. And it's not right by any means. But until we start talking about what the real underlying problem was, which was bullying, right? And then turning around and having a process. You know, the other thing, I was just in a rural South Texas, and we showed up to a presentation, and it was with their security committee, and they had formed, you know, they had taken the
Texas School Safety
Texas
Center,
School Safety Center TEA guidance of how to create your committee and all the different people that you had to have. You have to have a student, you have to have a teacher, you have to have all this kind of stuff. The one thing that was really interesting is they checked all the boxes and then some. And then when it came to law enforcement, they had everything from emergency management. They had Border Patrol. So they had federal agents there. They had county. They had marshals. They had every. It was a significant showing, right? And they had been involved in this process all the way through. I was blown away. These people were trying to do everything right. They really were. And they were tasked with this list of things that TEA had dropped on them. Yeah. Texas School Safety had dropped on them. Minimum requirements. All
do these things just don't, right? We're not going to tell you exactly how to do them. It's subjective.
100%. And so I'm in a room full of people who have never done this before. Not one of them have ever gone through this process on how to do these things. I mean, we had law enforcement there that knew how to respond to an emergency.
Right.
But they don't necessarily plan safety procedures, security procedures in the event of a chemical spill as it relates to a K-12 environment. That's not what their specialty is. We had emergency management there that knew NIMS inside and out, and they could talk about that. But as far as planning what you're going to do within the four walls of the school, that wasn't their expertise. So there wasn't a single person in the room that with on this committee that they had that had the expertise to take it from point A to point B. And there were so many things that they had to do in this checklist. And it was literally like shrugging, like, I don't know, right? Cybersecurity. Well, I've looked at, you know, videos from this one and this one and this one. I've talked to my ESC and they recommended these five. And I talked to this district over here, and this is what they're using. And so I think I kind of like these, right? And so anonymous reporting was one of the things that they were supposed to set up, right? And so this is where I'm coming back around. They didn't know how to do it, right?
And they don't know who needs to get what, why, right? How it needs to be distributed.
I need to set up a team. Okay, well, who needs to be on my team? Well, what qualifies them to be on a team? When does that person join the team? Based on the situation, and when do I get input from them versus, oh, well, this is now confidential, this is law enforcement, or this is health related, this party can no longer be involved. What's the process? They have very little guidance, and they are sitting here like literally reading the instructions to like an IKEA assembly project going, okay, it shows this and then it jumps to here. How do I get from here to there?
Yeah.
They might as well have done it with pictures because there's no guidance.
Well, the problem is there's no guidance. There's no standard on who's qualified to be a safety and security school director or whatever, right? You know, it's like the Texas School Safety Center, right? You could say I'm being critical, whatever. They're a good resource. They're a resource, right? $20+ million in funding a year. And they push out guidelines and best practices and, you know, here's your EOP. This is what an EOP looks like. And they give it to them as a template and then, hey, fill that out. Well, we need to know why, right? Why do I need to do this step? What's next in the step? That person needs to have an intimate knowledge of emergency operations and planning. You can't take a lifelong educator, give them a template and say, fill this out. It's like reading a foreign language. They don't know it, right?
Well, and I think what you're seeing now, and I would also love to know the stats on this, but I think you're seeing a bunch of the administrators who are exiting.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And it's because we continue to pile more and more and more and more responsibility.
Well, we're no longer really teaching kids.
Well, yeah, but the administrator is no longer a resource for the teachers because they now have
all these check boxes,
that
right?
They are having to do in these forms and do this on this so many days.
I tell you,
and that.
I feel bad for teachers and administrators now. I mean, the state just keeps, you know, and a lot of it, you know, and listen, we can get into other political conversations about, you know, voucher programs versus public school, whatnot. But it almost appears that to me, from a perspective of, you know, or my perception is that they're just heaping more crap on top of these administrators so that, you know,
I can
there's a mass exodus.
2 seconds though.
What's that?
I gotta change thing. Okay. So if we take a survey right now, let's just use Houston market as an example. In Houston, Texas, most of the private schools here already have a waiting list.
Oh, yeah. They're going to have a bigger waiting list.
So now you come back over and you make available, was it $4,000 or roughly?
I don't know what the voucher is. Okay. There's a decent voucher.
Well, let's say whatever the number is. Okay. If that private school was not an option for you today, based on whatever the funding is, because it doesn't work for you, right? The reality is the voucher program will not change anything. And that's because all the private schools will do is
raise the rates
exactly the amount of the voucher.
That's right.
Right.
Raise the rates.
Because the parents who are paying for private school today will see that as furthering what that school needs for resources. Mm-hmm. They get it to them. And instead of offering some type of discount, they now can work on facilities and services and everything else for students, right? They already have a waiting list. Why would they not raise their rates?
Yeah.
So I honestly believe that the voucher program is, we're going through all of this mess, right? And all of this turmoil and this fighting and everything out there. And at the end of the day, if you truly look at it and go, okay, we now have, let's just say it's 10,000 kids, right? Just in the Houston area that decide they want to go to private school right now. There isn't a spot for 10,000 kids in private school today. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Right. Where are they going to go? It doesn't matter what the amount of the voucher is.
Yeah.
There's physically not the resources to go. So what did we accomplish?
I think that, you know, I mean, me personally, I'm outspoken. I know that, you know, a lot of individuals who are supporting this voucher program, I don't support it because I believe that it will absolutely, I think it will eventually harm public education. I think it's going to harm public education. I think that what we're going to see is the true ugliness in American society when we allow people to choose what schools to go to based upon, you know, whatever their preference is. You're going to start seeing a separation of classes. You're going to start seeing a separation based upon race.
Well, let's take this a step further. We just talked about these schools having millions and millions and millions
deficits.
In deficits right now. Going into the 25-26 school year,
they lose right? They lose 10% of their kids.
Right? What happens if you turn around and now we take what money they do have and pull it back out of them?
Yeah.
What happens then? You're talking about a true financial collapse.
I think there's going to have to be the only way to resolve some of that once that happens is that a lot of these districts are going to have to consolidate. They're going to become bigger districts, which are even more of a problem. I mean, look at HISD, right?
Yep.
You know, just lost, you know, they were taken over by the state. They've got a new superintendent that came in, whole new board. You know, the state is being, you know, serving as a conservatorship.
You know, even when you look at that district, right? Not that any one of the other superintendents or board members or anything else through this turmoil, let's take the last 5 years. It's been a revolving door, right? And every time a superintendent got in there and got something going, they were out. And the next one was in.
Oh, yeah. Right?
It was over and over and over again. They were never there long enough to truly enact any change because they were already on such a straight.
It's too big. The district itself is too big. Well, I mean.
And the big districts that run like that, they actually run as smaller districts, right? So you look at some of the districts that are, let's say, 90 schools, right?
Yeah.
If you really look at how they run, they run as two divisions. So like some of them run as East and West,
mm-hmm.
and they have the duplication of the positions across the board,
right?
And
straight
they
down
split
the
it, because mm-hmm. even they have realized it's too big.
Because what HISD has, I think, what 283 campuses, something like that. I don't know how many exactly, but I mean, you look at other districts across the nation, large districts like New York. We'll talk about that here in just a little while with the surge of migrants. Mm-hmm. Clark County, Nevada, 300 yeah. and something schools.
Chicago,
yeah.
California has a couple of
you know, it could be done effectively, but it has to be done the right way. You know, and I don't think HISD, you know, having a single superintendent, you know, overseeing 283 campuses is the most effective way to do that. And so, but that's just me, you know, talking with my limited knowledge. You know, people will say, oh, you don't know shit. You weren't in schools that long, you know, but I know enough.
I don't know. Right. You had to navigate the executive board, and then you were on a board too. So
yeah, I was a school board member.
You definitely got to see it all facets yeah. of it. So, you know, getting back to where we started.
Yeah.
There's little to no guidance, right? And so we have extremely tight budgets, and the reality is that these schools need resources. You know, just like Cav told you when you came above, you know, your superintendent, when you came in, I have this specialist, I have that specialist, yeah. I need a security specialist.
Yeah.
Schools need a mental health specialist, right? And they need to have those things. And I've always, you know, it always surprises me to see when you meet with a school and you're going through an assessment and you're doing things and you start digging into it and then you make your recommendations and you need to have this, you need to have this mental health professional, you need to have this many people on your staff, you need to develop this program. And it's like, it wasn't even on their radar. Like, it's like, in some cases, they're aware that they need it, but you're talking a different language yeah. to them when you do that.
Because I, you know, listen, people can say what they want about teachers. And, you know, I'm going to defend them to the death. My wife's a teacher. You know, I know we've had conversations. You know, there's this old saying that, you know, those that can't teach, you know, and that's...
I didn't say that.
I didn't say you said that. I was repeating what I had heard. That's not what I said. My wife's a teacher. She's been an educator for 25 years almost. But
what you're telling us is that you're scared of your wife.
I am scared of my wife. I'm 5 foot of Italian woman, yeah. and she carries a knife.
Yeah.
And she grew up on a you know south side of Houston, Galveston County, in Lamarck, Texas. So yeah, it's uh-huh. you know we're. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is what it is. But what I'm getting at is I don't think that educators get the recognition that they deserve.
Or
I mean,
compensation.
You know, or compensation. You know, every time I go into these schools, I talk to these individuals, these administrators, and they're wearing 15 hats.
At least.
You know, and what it reminded me of is going through the Secret Service training when we were getting into our advanced training, you know, advanced site planning training, you know, due to the training environment, you know, we were having to do multiple jobs. You know, I was the site guy, then I was the lead, then I was the transportation guy, then I was, you know, you're wearing 15 different hats, and the state and the federal government just keeps heaping more responsibility on them, which is why we're seeing such a mass exodus of teachers in the United States.
The difference between that service training and in the K-12 space, that was cross training so that you could fill in any gap.
Yeah.
Anywhere. Yep. You there was somebody there who knew the deal.
Yeah.
In this case, the state is heaping on those administrators. There isn't
anybody else. Yeah. Yeah.
They're wearing all those hats because there is nobody yeah. else. It's not like they're filling yeah. in. As duties assigned, right?
Yeah,
and they just
sad,
keep assigning
man.
Duties and duties and duties.
It's sad, you know, because like, you know, my wife's been teaching 25 years and she absolutely loves her job, loves it. She loves the people that she works with, especially now. Her principal's fantastic. You know, the district that she's at, she loves it. But she's tired, you know, and she comes home and she talks about some of the new teachers that are just coming in from college, right? And how overwhelmed they are with all of the stuff that they have to do that is not really relevant to actually educating kids.
Right.
It's more procedural. It's checking paperwork. Boxes. It's paperwork that's irrelevant. You know, I have a sophomore in college right now, and I've got one that's going to be a freshman in August. And, you know, even having their friends over, we have like intellectual conversations. And as smart as some of these kids are, I feel like we have just completely lost touch with teaching the basics. I mean, simple things like geography, right? History, civil rights movement. You know, some of these important things that we need to know from a historical aspect of the United States, they don't know these things.
I have a funny one, and she's going to kill me for bringing it up, but during COVID was, you know, from teaching at home type stuff.
Yeah.
That was when my daughter was going through time. And so time zones are something, she never got the concept.
Yeah.
Right. So we've had to tell her, but it's been a lot of fun. You know, we recently took a trip to DC and, you know, a couple time zones over, right? And then seeing her try to process, you know, what,
okay, where are we at? What time zone is this?
Yeah. All of the things, right? Yeah. And it's like, wait a minute, it says on my calendar this. What do you mean we have to be there at that time? And you're like, it's the wrong thing. You didn't have this turned on. And it's like, I don't understand. And so it's just really funny that and so, you know, there's another thing of that, which we haven't even seen yet, is all those COVID kids
coming
out, right? Because there's a whole block. It doesn't matter where they were at, where we kind of got through the year, but maybe not really touched all the subjects.
I would like in about 20 years for someone to do a study and research. I'm sure somebody's probably already doing it. But the kids that were, let's say, first grade or pre-K to fourth grade during the time of COVID, mm-hmm. where that group of kids, what the statistics were of those kids that were in that age group of being institutionalized, because, you know, there's absolute data that states that if you can't read, you know, by the time you're in third grade, you have a higher risk of being institutionalized or working, you know, a minimum wage job. I would love to see those stats in 20 years. And I think what we're seeing also, and I said this, if you go back and watch some of my interviews during COVID, I said that I felt like COVID was going to have a tremendous impact on the educational space, not now, not, or not during, you know, 2020, 2021, but it'll be 2024, 2025, 2026, where those kids had lost all that instructional time, all of that, interaction, social interaction mm-hmm. with their peers. And I believe that we're going to have a mental health crisis, which I believe is what we're seeing right now. Well, we absolutely have a mental health crisis.
I think we have a mental health crisis now. I think it's going to be exponential.
It's going to be exponential in the next 2 to 3 years. And so, you know, I always get asked as a security advisor, consultant, we can talk about experts. That term gets thrown around a lot. I don't consider myself an expert. I consider myself a person who's well-rounded, right? I know a lot about some things
I think there's things between people who claim that they are an expert or have been assigned the title by somebody and they've run with it versus people who have actually done it.
Practitioners.
You know, I was laughing, and it's hard to convey to people, and it may come off cocky or conceited in some way, but it's not meant to be. But I was doing this presentation. There was another company there from a manufacturer, and they had a sales rep, and they had somebody from executive leadership there. And they had this company that was going to install a system. And collectively, I had three, arguably four times the experience, me personally,
than their
all
whole team
of them combined.
Right.
And so it's one of those things that you literally want to go back in there and be like, yeah, this is, you know, I've seen a thing or two because we've done a thing or two, right? Like
State Farm.
Yeah, I know. But like, I mean, seriously, it's like, why choose us over them is that, you know, they literally just haven't been doing it. And so that's the difference between somebody who, let's say, you know, was a security officer or a personal protection officer, or let's say an ex-cop or a SWAT team guy.
Yeah.
They're never going to be able to do things like you do because of all the things that you just said. You were trained in all of these things from what you did for a living to protect somebody. within an organization that just focuses on protecting people, and they're just not going to do it. You know, if you look at, it's a totally different methodology and mindset from SWAT and a police officer truly being reactionary, right? And the service being proactive, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to identify what threat is real, and I'm trying to prevent it before it becomes a threat, which is why we've seen the service take the lead in
behavioral threat,
right? Mm-hmm. And it's because it's different. How come no other law enforcement agency, why hasn't LAPD SWAT come forward as the nation's leader in behavioral threat management? Because that's not what they do. So when you take a guy off the SWAT team and you put him into a position of something where we're doing consulting with you or something like that, it's totally different.